Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, a stimulating look at culture, current events, faith, and politics from a Christian and conservative point of view. We don't just talk on the radio, we blog too. Check us out at caffeinatedthoughts.com. Now grab a cup of coffee and join us. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio.
And welcome back to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Caffeinated Thoughts Radio is brought to you in part by Myers & Associates, serving the Midwest with industrial maintenance products and services. Call them at 515-795-3676. Myers & Associates, keeping your operations running. Welcome back to another week of Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. This is Shane Vanderhurt with Brian Myers and got Ron Carlson. Brian, we've missed you.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
And glad to have you back.
How long have I been gone, anyway?
Well, at least 2 weeks. Last 2 weeks, I think.
I can't remember.
Seems like years.
Yeah, I think you've been noticeably absent in December. So we're good to get you in on the last show of 2016.
Well, thank you, sir. I understand you've been under the weather.
Yes. Yeah.
What's the matter with you, anyway?
Today either, but you know, I just
well, you normally look like you've been run over by a truck anyway, because you stay up half the night. So when you show up,
okay, just for clarity,
so how am I going to know the difference?
To set the record straight, I do not stay up half the night generally.
Not you, never.
I stay up late, but not half the night, because I'm a night owl. But no,
so it's 3/4 of the night.
Yeah.
In any case,
before 11 o'clock last night.
How am I going to tell the difference between a normal day in the studio and you having been sick this week? How do I know the difference?
Well,
what are the telltale signs?
I'm not sure you could tell the difference right now if you're accusing me of being tired all the time. But because I feel pretty wiped out this week.
You got a cold or a flu or what?
It's some sort of bug that our family just keeps on regifting to one another.
Well, you're sitting six or seven feet away from me. That's a good thing.
It's just, I don't know. I've been wiped out and body aches and
maybe we can make that 8 or 10
feet. So anyway, I don't know if the room accommodate that. I don't know. We could try.
Well, have you been able to enjoy this good weather that we got this week? Since you've been under the weather, have you been able to enjoy the good weather?
No. I've been pretty much, last 2 days, it was totally, I was totally oblivious to what was going on in the world. I wasn't on social media. All I wanted to do was sleep or watch, you know, I was watching Netflix. Basically, that's all I was doing.
Well, I'll tell you what, the weather has been awesome. I just want to make a quick observation here. What was it, 2 weeks ago this Sunday, it was 14 below zero.
Yeah.
And a few days later, I'm in central Wyoming, and it's 54 degrees.
Yeah.
It was an awesome change, I'll tell you.
And it's, you know, warm in Iowa, too. And you know, hey, it's Iowa. This is
what it does.
Abnormal is normal.
But I'm enjoying this little respite. I understand it's supposed to get cold next week. But for the moment, it is very nice. And with that weather report, perhaps we should introduce our guest.
Yes. William Jacobson's been on our show once before.
He's decided to come back.
I know. He's a founder of Legal Insurrection and College Insurrection, and a clinical professor of law and the director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, William.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome.
Hey, William. This past week, we had some interesting developments at the UN with regard to an anti-Israel resolution. That's the best way I could describe it. Can you tell us exactly what happened? Give us maybe a 50,000-foot view of the whole thing.
Sure. Essentially what happened is it's not uncommon for anti-Israel resolutions to come up at the UN. In fact, in the General Assembly, where the U.S. doesn't have a veto, I think there were 20 this year. They don't focus on any country as much as they do Israel. But in the U.N. Security Council, the U.S. does have a veto. So it's unusual, not unheard of, but it's very unusual for an anti-Israel resolution to pass the Security Council. Now, the Security Council is very important because it's essentially the enforcement wing of the United Nations. The General Assembly can pass whatever they want, and it literally means nothing. It's just an expression of opinion. But it's the Security Council that has the muscle at the UN. So typically what happens is the U.S. signals when these resolutions come up, that we're going to veto it, so don't bother. And so they don't even get brought up. Occasionally, they do get brought up, but the U.S. will typically veto the resolution. It's been 36 years, 1980 under Jimmy Carter, since the U.S. has failed to veto, has abstained on an anti-Israel resolution, which arguably affects the rights of where Jews are allowed to live in Israel. And what happened this time, there was a resolution brought up, again, first time in 36 years that it's been allowed to pass, which effectively declares anything, any people, any Israelis, de facto Jews, any Jews living beyond what they call the 1967 lines, mm-hmm. So that was before the Six-Day War, to be illegal, flagrant violation of international law. And that's obviously very significant. Now, just for your listeners, the so-called 1967 line is actually not a line. It's actually the 1949 armistice line.
Right.
What happened is in 1948, Israel declared independence. It was invaded by several armies from Arab countries, including Jordan. Jordan seized what is now called the West Bank. It was supposed to be part of Israel under the the League of Nations mandate. So it was supposed to be part of Israel. Jordan illegally invaded and seized it. And it, as happens frequently, for example, Korea, at some point people say, we're going to stop fighting. And they entered into an armistice agreement that basically where the troops are at this moment in time is where they're going to stay. But the armistice agreement specifically said this is not to be considered a final boundary of the countries. The Israelis didn't want it because they felt, hey, wait a second, Jordan, you just seized land from us, including the old city of Jerusalem, including the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. You just seized that, Jordan. We're not going to agree that that's a permanent seizure. From Jordan's point of view and the Arab point of view, they didn't want to agree that that was the final border because they wanted to still destroy Israel, but they were going to have to wait for another day. So
Right. Essentially
from 1949, when they signed the armistice agreement, until 1967, that's just where people stayed. In 1967, people know Israel, after Egypt had closed international waters to Israel, which is considered under international law an act of war,
mm-hmm.
when Syria threatened to invade, Israel attacked Syria and attacked Egypt preemptively to wipe out their air forces. What most people don't know is Israel did not initially attack Jordan. Israel said to Jordan, it's well documented, that if you stay out of the war, we will not attack you. Jordan attacked Israel anyway. And it was in that counterattack against Jordan that Israel seized the rest of Jerusalem and what is now commonly referred to as the West Bank of the Jordan River. So people need to understand that this was land that was originally supposed to be part of Israel. When the Jordanians seized it in 1949, they literally expelled all Jews. They ransacked the Jewish quarter of the old city. They ransacked Jewish cemeteries and used the tombstones for road paving. And so what has happened after 67 is Jews have essentially returned to the areas from which they were expelled by the Jordanians. That now, somehow, has become the internationally recognized no-go boundary. The UN is now saying that for the Jews to return to those areas is a flagrant violation of international law. The Israelis obviously say, no way. You're telling us that literally Jews can't live in the Jewish quarter of the old city?
Yeah.
You're telling us that Jews can't control the western wall of the Temple Mount, which is, it's not the holiest site in Judaism. The holiest site in Judaism is actually on the Temple Mount.
Right.
But it's the closest site to the holiest site. So it's the holiest site at which Jews are allowed to pray.
Right.
We can't control that. And that's really the nub here. And now a lot of people, and that's the problem, that this resolution essentially said that it's illegal for Jews to live there unless the Palestinians agree, which of course they're not going to do.
Right.
So it was considered to be a negative substantively, contrary to U.S. policy for the last 36 years, which is this is not illegally occupied territory. It's disputed territory. And I agree with that. There are two competing sets of claims to this territory. And the policy of the U.S. has always been that that has to be subject to negotiation directly between the parties.
Right.
And the U.S. essentially abrogated that by allowing to pass a resolution which said, no, that's Palestinian territory. You have to get out. And that's really the problem. There are other problems I can get into, but yeah, that's the nub of the problem.
You're listening to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, and on the line we have William Jacobson with Legal Insurrection and the law professor with Cornell Law School.
Well, William, back up just a little bit, because I know John Kerry, you mentioned this violation of international law. John Kerry earlier this week called the settlements a flagrant violation of international law. Can you explain their rationale again?
Well, first, is it illegally occupied territory? That's the first step you get to. And the Israelis, and I agree with this view, take the position it's not illegally occupied territory because it was territory that was originally supposed to be part of Israel. It was territory illegally seized by Jordan. Only two countries in the world recognize Jordan's occupation of the West Bank, Britain and Pakistan. It was not an internationally recognized occupation by Jordan. And that, so the Israeli point of view is that we reclaimed in a defensive war, because we were attacked by Jordan. We didn't attack Jordan. In a defensively declared war, that we recaptured territory that was supposed to be ours.
Right, but what I'm missing here is this: what international laws are you referring to?
Well, what people try to invoke is the Geneva Convention, which was actually put in place later, after World War II, and but that doesn't apply here because the Geneva Conventions have to be agreements between countries. The countries have to be signatories. Jordan was not a signatory. There was no country with which Israel agreed by treaty to be bound by these conventions. So that's the first point. The second point is that, again, you have to go back to the start, which is this was territory under the League of Nations that was supposed to be the Jewish homeland. That international law, the League of Nations, was never abrogated. In fact, when the UN came into creation, it specifically said that whatever the League of Nations, and I'm paraphrasing, whatever the League of Nations has already established will continue at the United Nations, essentially the successor organization. So when it gets to the issue of settlement, under the Geneva Conventions, it is unlawful for an occupying power to transfer populations to areas that it occupies.
Okay.
And that was done because Germany forcibly transferred people to land, to territory it seized during World War II.
Okay.
And the history of the word transfer, it means forcible transfer.
Mm-hmm.
There's no international
law. That's not what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not what's going on here. There's no international law that prevents a Jew from buying a piece of property on the West Bank or from Israel on land that is considered state land. And it's a very complicated land formula. They actually use the old Ottoman because this was occupied by the Ottoman Empire for several centuries.
Mm-hmm.
They look at Ottoman Empire land practices and land law as to what we would call state land. So
okay.
The settlements that have been built are privately purchased property and are built on state land. The notion that Israel is simply, you know, taking a village, kicking the people out, and putting Jews in there is not what's happening. So there's a whole level of complexity here which is not reflected in the repeated claim, which is essentially just like repeating for the sake of propaganda, illegal occupation, illegal settlement.
These are disputed issues. The Obama administration's refusal to veto this resolution was ranked Tuesday as the most anti-Semitic incident of all of 2016 by the Simon Wiesenthal, did I say that correctly, Center?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's obviously a pretty strong indictment. Can you tell us, I know you've told us in general terms, is there any, getting down into the weeds a little bit in the specifics of the resolution, is there anything else that we need to know about it?
Well, one thing that I think is also important in the resolution, and that not a lot of people are focusing on, you may know that there's this worldwide boycott movement against Israel.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually been going on for decades, but it's come into the forefront, particularly in the last 10 years. In the resolution, it calls upon all nations to distinguish in their dealings between Israel and the so-called occupied territories. What it is, it's essentially a call for a boycott of Israeli businesses that do business in the Jewish quarter or anywhere in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank of Israelis who live there. And that is really a backhanded boycott of Israel, because the nature of the Israel economy is, you know, a company that produces milk in Israel probably sells it in the Jewish quarter, which they're now claiming is illegal, probably sells it to people who live outside Jerusalem in the so-called West Bank. So there, the other part of this resolution that's very pernicious is not just the substantive point about whose territory this is. It's essentially giving a boost to a call to boycott Israel.
What prompted this, and I mean we have just a few seconds left, William, what prompted this, especially given the short amount of time that the current administration has left?
I think it's just a lashing out. It's a last-minute lashing out that the Israelis did not, in the administration's mind, give in enough. Now, people can dispute that. The Israelis dispute that. A lot of people say it's the Palestinian refusal to compromise.
Hey.
But whoever's right or wrong, the administration, Obama administration's feel that Israel...
And we are out of time. Thank you.
Hi, this is Brian Myers of Myers & Associates. If you're involved in maintenance at a manufacturing plant, you know how costly it can be when a machine goes down. And if the reason that machine went down is because the electronic controls on it failed, it can really be problematic if those electronics are obsolete. Well, not to worry. We represent Providence Industrial Electronics Repair, and they can get your machine up and running in no time. They repair boards, drives, servo motors, light curtains, you name it. So if you need industrial electronics repaired at your plant, or if you have other industrial maintenance needs, give me a call at 515-490-2640. That's Myers & Associates, 515-490-2640. Myers & Associates, keeping your operations running.
And welcome back to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Caffeinated Thoughts Radio is brought to you in part by Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. Call Travis at 515-883-0029, and he can help you find the life insurance
you need.
So on the line, we have a very special guest, Reverend Michael Ives. He's the pastor of the Presbyterian Reformed Church of Rhode Island, and he's currently working on his PhD at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary. Hey, welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, Michael.
Great to be here, Shane.
Good to have you. So Brian wants to, he's going to launch into what we're talking about this segment.
Yeah, Michael, why don't you talk a little bit about your PhD studies with respect to a certain Scottish theologian from the 19th century.
Aye, it would be my pleasure. It's basically my focus is on Thomas Chalmers, who in the first part of the 19th century was really a household name, probably not as well known nowadays, but in his days, he was a very prominent figure. He was quite a spellbinding preacher. There were flocks of people that would come to him, even from the higher orders, including men like William Wilberforce, who once wrote "The World is Wild About Chalmers," and even got some notorious props, as it were, from somebody like Karl Marx, who called him the Arch Parson. He was a prominent preacher, churchman, and especially noted as an innovative philanthropist during the Industrial Revolution, where there was a mass migration from the countryside into the large sprawling cities. And he was prominently known for his efforts to fight poverty on that scale.
I heard on CBS News, of all places, several years ago, many years ago, actually, one of the news anchors on their morning show refer to Thomas Chalmers as the world's first sociologist. What do we make of that?
Yeah, well, there's certainly something to that, even within the discipline, as I understand it, of social work and sociology. He's an early thinker. He was very much of a humanist and interested in how people think and how they think in groups and act and behave, and that feeds into his philanthropic theory and practice.
Before we get started talking about Chalmers' approach in some of these things, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what 19th century Glasgow, where his parish was at. Tell us a little bit about what the city was like at that time.
Yeah, well, you know, we read novels like, you know, from Jane Austen, and we get this very idyllic, romantic picture of what it was like to live in Britain during this time. Everything is warm and fuzzy. That certainly wasn't the case for a massive swath of the population. You had people who were uprooted from their livelihoods. Industry was changing with the developments of mechanized industry. And you had people coming to these cities just in hordes to work in these long hours in factories in unthinkable conditions. And Thomas Chalmers, when he took his first charge in Glasgow after his conversion, he had a rural parish ministry, first as an unconverted man, actually, and then the Lord saved him from his cold moderatism. And took that charge after that in Glasgow, where he went door to door and saw some of the most horrific, squalid living conditions with, you know, tons of people in apartments, drunkenness, it was a desperate situation. Hard to imagine, but really it was kind of third world kind of living situation for so many people.
And at that time, Glasgow had to be, in terms of its populace, its population had to be, by those standards, by 19th century standards, it had to be a huge city, correct?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So what made Thomas Chalmers revolutionary, if I can use that word, what made him revolutionary in his thinking or his approach to the parish and to the poor?
Yeah, well, you know, because there were so many changes during society at that time, things were becoming staggering in their proportion in terms of spiritual, moral, social, economic problems. And he came into the city where there was just an awful lot of social dislocation and accelerating poverty. And he basically took kind of an old rural model of community care as mm-hmm. a pastor in the first case, seeking to really to recreate community in a city where there was an awful lot of anonymity and really communities just did not exist. And then pioneering an old rural voluntary method of charity where basically charity is viewed as it had been in the past, something that was a communal responsibility and involved a lot of face-to-face interaction and wasn't something that was from the top down by bureaucratic fiat and the bungling around of the management of charity. And he really pioneered an old model in a new situation within Glasgow in the St. John's Parish from 1819 to 1823. And a lot of people looked to it as a success and as a model, as an alternative to what was increasingly becoming state legalized charity, basically charity by taxation and reappropriation.
I was going to ask you that. So by that time, the nation of Scotland had moved towards I'm going to use the word welfare here. That may not be what they called it, but they were moving towards a welfare state even at that time, correct?
Yes, England was kind of leading the movement at that time, and Chalmers saw that. It was making its inroads into Scotland, and he firmly stood opposed to that as a false kind of benevolence, however well-motivated, but calculated to really aggravate the problem extremely.
So talk about that. How did it make it worse? What was his objection to that?
Well, basically, his objection to that was that it was very wrong-headed, however well-intentioned maybe some may have been in advocating that. And one can understand when one sees massive poverty, the question is, what do we do? And let's do it fast.
Mm-hmm.
But he basically said, listen, we realize there are an awful lot of changes in society. We don't doubt that. But human nature stays the same. And charity cannot fundamentally disregard essential characteristics of the human being and humans within society. He argued that there were essentially four natural fountains of charity within community, human community. And the first was self-reliance. Legalized charity in which charity becomes something of a right, a legal claim that a poor person has. There's this tendency to lure people away from their own ability to care for themselves. Second, it really aggravates the extreme social dislocation that was going on with respect to the nuclear family, if we can use 20th century terms. Family needs to get involved in helping those who are truly unable to work, and legalized charity basically bypasses that and gives family kind of a pass to ignore, a cousin, friend, a brother, sister, mother, as well as neighbors themselves. It totally aggravates the fact that community didn't exist within the cities, and community needs to come together to help each other, neighbors with neighbors. So those are the kinds of things he said. Listen, by legalized charity, you're stopping up these natural fountains and wells of a community's ability to medicate and heal itself socially and economically.
So when you talk about self-reliance, did he have a view about the necessity and dignity of labor that indiscriminate aid from the state robs from the common man?
Absolutely. And that's another, aspect of things that he was very concerned about, was retaining the dignity of the poor. It only degrades and demoralizes these people when they aren't really genuinely helped, giving a hand up instead of a hand out, as it were. And one of the things that he did going into Glasgow and beginning the St. John's Parish, in which he basically made a special arrangement with the city that, listen, can we not contribute to the central fund that gets reallocated to the different parishes, but we'll keep it ourselves, and then we'll go care for this community. We'll raise up some deacons who will visit these people door to door, get to know them, get to know their real situations. Are they able-bodied? Can we help them find work? And enable them to get onto their own two feet, and also to help them educationally with respect to the children, which at that time was a major problem. Education was not universal as it is today.
Well, that had to be a real revolutionary thing at the time as well, just the notion of them keeping the funding local and controlling that locally, as opposed to handing it off to the bureaucracy to be dispensed. That he had to get some blowback on that, didn't he?
Yeah, he certainly did. But, again, his arguments often involved coming back to human nature and how people actually function, is that, when charity becomes a legalized thing and bureaucracy develops, is that there's this moral distance that he said is created between the giver and the receiver. And instead of it being a matter of generosity in a face-to-face situation in a real life context, this central fund becomes kind of this great heavenly body from which, if I can only get connected to it, I'll be helped. Well, that basically short circuits so many different natural connections of humanity with respect to the whole enterprise of benevolence, which frustrates things in a whole number of different ways.
Yeah, now he was criticized at his time as saying that his approach was impossible in larger cities, right?
It's like, yeah, he was criticized in that way, and even to this day, some argue that his successes, the St. John's experiment and others like that, were not quite the robust successes that he claimed that they were. However, that being said, one also needs to understand that increasingly, Britain and Scotland eventually didn't listen and didn't cooperate, and we're living even now today, I think, in the West with the consequences of that, and to actually help the poor in these kinds of ways, it's difficult because there's the headwind of the modern welfare state.
Well, yeah, I just think of look at the 19th century, you know, at the turn of the century, before the turn of the 19th century, or 20th century anyway, all the hospitals, most of the hospitals, most of the orphanages, most of, you know, any type of social welfare was really driven by the church. And then things changed, especially when you had the income tax that was the 17th Amendment, I think it was.
It was somewhere.
Not 17th.
It was during the Wilson administration.
Yeah.
So it would have been.
Whenever they passed, I can't think of the actual amendment, whenever they passed the income tax amendment allowing Congress to pass an income tax, then suddenly, you know, I think charity started going. We started seeing more of the welfare state.
Michael, we've got just about less than a minute. Can you tell us real quickly, what can we learn from Chalmers in our present situation, and what about social relief in its relation to the gospel? Try to give us about 20 or 30 seconds there.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, major on the majors. Major on going and bringing the gospel to localities, but doing so intelligently and realizing that there is not just a soul but a body. He focused on locality because really you need to have face-to-face interactions with people to bring them the gospel, but also to help them morally and socially. And that's certainly worth carrying over into the modern day, regardless of what the political situations in which we live are.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Risvold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a better or the best life insurance plan for you, call my friend Travis Risvold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. Travis Risvold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, a stimulating look at culture, current events, faith, and politics from a Christian and conservative point of view. We don't just talk on the radio, we blog too. Check us out at caffeinatedthoughts.com. Now grab a cup of coffee and join us. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio.
And welcome back to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Caffeinated Thoughts Radio is brought to you in part by Crosswalk Ministries with Scott Owen, who offers biblical counseling and conciliation. Give him a call at 515-292-7141 or go to crosswalkcounseling.org.
And now it's time to do our news segment, otherwise affectionately known as News You Can Use. Okay, first up, CNN ran a story that Russia was closing an Anglo-American school in Moscow as retaliation for President Obama's sanctions. Russian authorities ordered the closure of the Anglo-American School of Moscow, a U.S. official briefed on the matter said. The order from the Russian government closes the school, which serves children of U.S., British, and Canadian embassy personnel, to U.S. and foreign nationals, reported CNN. However, Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zarikova, I think I said that right, responded swiftly by denying that the school had been closed. U.S. officials anonymously informed their media that Russia closed the Anglo-American school in Moscow as a retaliatory measure, she wrote on her official Facebook page. That's a lie. Apparently, the White House has completely lost its senses and began inventing sanctions against its own children. She accused CNN of spreading false information, citing official American sources. So we really don't know where we stand on this one, Shane.
Right, right. And it's interesting. It'd be good to see a statement from the actual school itself, where they stand. Because I don't want to just, buy into what the Russians say.
Right, and CNN was not apparently the only one that reported it.
Right.
I believe it was NBC ran that story this morning, or Friday morning as well. So we'll have to see what happens from there. Next up, on a related issue, next up from Zero Hedge. Following this morning's reports that Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov would recommend to Russian President Vladimir Putin a retaliation in kind and expel 35 American diplomats, saying that we cannot leave such acts unanswered.
And just for our listeners who aren't aware, President Obama has decided to expel 35 Russian diplomats in response to, as well as close to Russian compounds in response to the CIA report on Russian involvement in our 2016 election.
Yeah, I should have had that in the beginning here.
That's okay.
Reciprocity is part of diplomatic law, with Putin's spokesperson Peskov adding that there is no doubt that Russia's adequate and mirror response will make Washington officials feel very uncomfortable as well. It was ultimately up to Putin to decide how to respond to the U.S., which he did on Friday morning. In a stunning reversal, the Russian leader took to the high road, rejected the Lavrov proposal, and in a statement posted by the Kremlin said that Russia won't expel any Americans in retaliation to U.S. moves, in a brutal demonstration of just how irrelevant Obama's 11th hour decision is for U.S.-Russian relations. And Shane got a statement that was released not long ago, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Just within the last hour, I'd say.
Yes.
And this is, of course, Friday morning, but This is from Mr. Putin himself. The diplomats who are returning to Russia will spend New Year's holidays with their families and friends. We will not create any problems for U.S. diplomats. We will not expel anyone. We will not prevent their families and children from using their traditional leisure sites during the New Year's holidays. Moreover, I invite all children of U.S. diplomats accredited in Russia to the New Year and Christmas children's parties in the Kremlin. It is regrettable that the Obama administration is ending its term in this manner. Nevertheless, I offer my New Year's greetings to President Obama and his family.
Well, earlier in the statement, it's even more of a dig. It's like, we will not resort to irresponsible kitchen diplomacy. We will plan our further steps to restore Russian-U.S. relations based on the policies of the Trump administration.
Yeah, he finishes with this. My season's greetings also to President-elect Donald Trump and the American people. I wish all of you happiness and prosperity. I tell you what, you got to give this round to Putin.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he looks like the good guy here.
He does, yeah.
And Obama looks not only irrelevant, but small.
Definitely.
All right, next up, this is from the Daily Caller. Despite repeated assurances to the contrary from the Obama administration, and despite the lack of any supporting evidence, a majority of Democrats believe a conspiracy theory in which Russia tampered with the voting tallies in last month's election to rig the outcome in favor of Donald Trump, according to a New Economist poll released Tuesday. According to the polling results, 17% of registered Democrats says it's definitely true that Russia tampered with vote tallies in order to get Donald Trump elected president, while another 35% said the conspiracy theory was probably true. The Obama administration has consistently said that the November elections were free and fair and that no hacking of voting machines took place. The polling results are just the latest indication that not all Democrats appear willing to accept an election in which a Clinton victory was considered all but a sure thing. Now, what's important here is not that people suspect the Russians of hacking.
Mm-hmm.
These folks are saying that the Russians actually falsified the election results by their hacking into what had to be hundreds of computer systems. The whole thing's nuts.
And considering that, and I don't, when you consider how many moving parts there are to a presidential election,
it's absurd.
And you know, again, thank you to the Electoral College, which makes voter fraud of this caliber practically impossible.
Well, stop and think about this. I mean, think of all the precincts, all the counties, all the states that have different voting systems.
Right.
Many of them involving hard copies.
Right. Right.
And I don't care how you slice it to pull off what these people believe apparently happened.
Well,
it's something out of a Tom Cruise movie.
Not to mention she won the national pop. If you're gonna affect anything, you would affect the national popular vote, and she won the national popular vote. So that means Russia not only have to hack in these systems, they'd have to figure out which states to do it in.
Yep.
And this, again, is why pointing out why we need the Electoral College, because it makes that practically impossible.
And can I just point out the fact that these are the people that suggest that conservatives and Republicans are not as well informed. They're not as highly educated as the left is. And yet they would believe, I won't use what I think this is, I'll use a different word, shall we say, the malarkey.
Malarkey. Ooh, I like that. I
mean, think about this, though. I mean, what they are suggesting could possibly happen is just beyond absurd. Okay. Last up, this is from The Atlantic. There aren't many people like Michael Ware in today's Democrat Party. The former director of Barack Obama's 2012 faith outreach efforts is a theologically conservative evangelical Christian. What in the world he's doing in the Obama administration, I don't know. But he is opposed to both abortion and same-sex marriage, although he would argue that those are primarily theological positions, and other issues, including poverty and immigration, are also important to his faith. During his time working for Obama, he was often alone in many of his views, he writes in his new book, which is called Reclaiming Hope. He helped with faith outreach strategies for Obama's 2008 campaign, but was surprised when some state-level officials decided not to pursue this kind of engagement. And he's rather unhappy about how this all turned out. Go figure.
Anyway, this is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, Uptown,
down home, American kids. Is God punishing me? Does he hate me? What did I do to deserve these trials? I'm Scott Owen with Crosswalk Ministries of Central Iowa, and it's time to pause for peace. Pain and trials are commonly assumed to be signs that you do not have peace with God. Even the famous sufferer in the Bible, Job, endured accusations from his friends that his hardships were punishment from God. Yet the Bible offers several purposes of trials in the life of a believer. One such purpose is that hard times allow us to experience the fullness of God's comfort and grace to the point that we are able to comfort others that are in affliction. The Bible says, "The God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction, with the comfort with which we ourselves ourselves are comforted by God. If you want peace with God, give us a call at 515-635-5465 or online at crosswalkcounseling.org. That number again, 515-635-5465.
Hey, do you want to take advantage of the marketing potential within social media for your company or organization, but you're not so sure how? Let me help. My company, 415 Communications, is a social media consulting firm that works with groups like yours. Go to 415communications.com or give me a call at 515-321-5077.
And now we've come to Shane's favorite part of the show.
Yes, it is.
We are about to share a story that is truly unbelievable. Yet. Did I say yet?
Yet.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say yet?
Yet.
Did you say yet yet?
Yeti?
Yeah.
Yet. You know it must be true because...
You can't make this stuff up.
You're a little slow on the draw again.
Well, you know it's a computer issue. It's not me.
Yeah. You'll probably go back and fix it later. And then make my comment completely irrelevant because I've seen you do that.
I can leave it in if you'd like. It's not a problem.
Okay, this is from BuzzFeed.
BuzzFeed.
This is about Bethany Howell from Little Rock, Arkansas, and her 6-year-old daughter, Ashland. Earlier this month, Howell and Ashland sat down one night to watch a movie. Probably about 4 or 5 minutes into the movie, I fell asleep unintentionally, Howell told BuzzFeed, and that's when she got on my phone.
Oh, no.
You don't even need to read anything else. I can just imagine.
Howell didn't realize it at the time, not until her husband got home and said he'd noticed nearly $250 on Amazon. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't purchase anything. She said, we thought we'd been hacked at first. The two logged into the app and noticed all 13 purchased items were Pokemon toys, her daughter's current obsession, and they were all being delivered to their home address. From there, I was like, well, if you didn't shop and I didn't shop, there's only one other person in the house that could have done this. The next morning, while getting Ashlyn ready for school, Howell asked her about her little shopping spree, and she said, yeah, Mommy, I was shopping, but don't worry. All of it's coming straight to the house.
Well, good.
Okay, wait for it, folks. Howell said, then I asked her, how'd you get into my phone? Did you remember my code? And she said, no, I used your thumb.
Obviously, yeah, as an iPhone 5S or greater, probably.
Howell said her daughter really didn't understand how much it cost or how money works, so they taught her about it that night and told her the next time she wants to buy something that she has to ask and she also has to earn it. The bad news? Only 4 of the toys were returnable. The good news? Howell hadn't done her Christmas shopping yet. We told her the next morning that the elf on the shelf went back to Santa Claus and told him what happened. And he decided to intercept those presents and he would bring them on Christmas morning. So on Christmas morning, she was opening things saying, this is what Santa brought me. I ordered it, and he brought it to me.
Gosh.
But now, is this amazing or what? While this woman's asleep, yeah. This little girl has the wherewithal to go get the phone and put her thumb on that baby. I mean...
That is crazy. Here, I thought Touch ID, like, oh, yeah, this will prevent, stuff like this happening on the phone. I'm glad this is another reason why I don't have a lot of shopping-type apps on my phone.
Yeah. Well, do you think Cheryl's going to come to you while you're asleep and put your thumb on there?
I'm thinking my youngest daughter, Lily, might be tempted to. No, she wouldn't do that. Fortunately, I've got older kids.
But my question to you is, would you sleep through such a thing where somebody is messing around with your thumb, putting it on the...
Depends on how tired I am. I can be a heavy sleeper at times.
And she might have just brought the phone to the thumb instead of the thumb to the phone.
I tell you what, if I'm so tired I'm falling asleep out in the living room, then I could definitely see something like that happening.
A resourceful little gal.
Yes, she is.
Send your You Can't Make This Stuff ideas to story@caffeinatedthoughts.com. We'll give you the credit or the blame if we use your suggestion on the show.
Thanks a lot, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Take care.